Your Financial Choices may discuss various financial-related topics and thus would like to offer the following disclosures. Lori Siebert is employed by Valley National Group, the Valley National Financial Advisors Group of Companies. Investments are offered through Valley National Investments Incorporated, member FINRA. We inform you that any federal tax, state tax, financial advice, or information contained in this communication is not intended to be personalized or specific in nature, or to be relied upon for your personal situation in any circumstance. The advice and information are not intended and cannot be used as a tax opinion letter, nor used for the purpose of avoiding tax-related penalties. For personalized advice specific to your own situation, we recommend that you consult your CPA, CFP, or attorney.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I'm a CPA, CFP, and AEP on the web at yourfinancialchoices.com. And you can listen online each and every week at wdiy.org. You can mention that to friends and family outside of our listening area as well. You can stream live while we're on, or podcasts are available on the website as well. You just go under the WDIY.org website, look for local programming, you'll find Your Financial Choices, and you'll see prior shows that we've done. We aim to provide lots of educational information to help you in your financial choices and in your decision making, etc. I think when we are armed with information, that helps us make better decisions, but we have to be careful on what information we're armed with. We want to make sure we understand what we're talking about, what kinds of questions we need to ask. So I think it's really important to get that information, but also make sure that you are getting the proper information and using professionals who help bring it all together for you. I have seen a number of cases where folks have relied on maybe circumstances, information, situations that they are familiar with, maybe because of family or friends telling them, I did it this way, do it this way, why don't you try this, why don't you do that? And while I think it's always good to get people's opinions, sometimes circumstances that apply to you may not be what applied to them. So you want to make sure that you're gathering all the information for your particular circumstances and not and understanding that yours might be different. So we're going to talk about financial terms today. Last week, I talked about investment terms and understanding that you can go online and look up investment terms. What we tried to do is actually kind of highlight the most, important kind of investment terms that you would want to get your arms around. And tonight, I want to do the same with financial terms. So we're going to get the show started. The markets were mixed today. The Dow closing up at 22,016. That's pretty high. And the NASDAQ was fairly flat, but a down a tiny bit, 6,362. And the S&P was up at 2,477. So just so you know, if you're not a regular listener, this is a live show. We take questions. If you are not comfortable talking live on air, you can call in and give your question to Lori C., who's in the studio. She'll write it down and bring it in to me. I'll answer the question as best I can. If it's live on air, you'll just be put through and we will talk on the phone. The number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. And we do ask you to mute your radio so you can hear me without the delay and we can talk without confusion. We do discuss general financial planning topics and not specific investments. And while I typically have a topic each week, you can still ask questions off topic. I'll do my best to answer them. Also, email is available at yourfinancialchoices.com if you need to email me a question. So, financial terms. So last year, I did what I would call investment terms, and that included things like passive management, active management, ETFs, index funds, mutual funds, bonds, securities, what different kinds of bonds, government bonds, corporate bonds, municipal bonds. What else did we talk about? That was a lot of the investment terms, asset allocation, diversification. So tonight, financial terms, what am I talking about? Well, banking, since most of us at some time in our life will have a bank account, I want to talk about some banking terms as far as titling goes on the accounts that you're setting up. It's a little bit about FDIC insurance. I'm going to talk about estate planning terms because I think these tend to be some of the most confusing, and I would argue possibly on purpose. And then I will, if I have time, talk about advisor designations so that you understand what the different designations might mean and why it's important to know the differences. And then again, if I have further time, I'm going to talk about some terms we might hear when we're talking about retirement accounts. What is pre-tax, after-tax, employer match, catch-up contributions, SPD, summary plan document? What do those terms mean? And then finally, last on my list, because I do whole shows on this, might be some terms we hear about in the tax arena, things like AGI, tax deduction versus a tax credit. So let me get started on terms, financial terms. I like folks to kind of have their arms around a little bit. It'll help when you're doing setting up bank accounts or when you're doing your own estate planning. Or if you have a loved one who passes away, it might be important for you to know what kind of account they had if you happen to be on that account as well. So let me give the phone number one more time, 610-758-8810. And again, that's live, or if you're not comfortable talking live on air, just give your question to Lori C. in the studio and she'll write it down and bring it in to me. So banking terms, all legal terms in property law and are basically what I'm going to kind of go over. We want you to seek legal advice when setting up your own accounts if you don't understand what is involved. So we talk about tenants in common. Tenants in common, each ownership interest of property is independent and can be passed on to each owner's heir. So typically we see tenants in common maybe where you might have a buddy and you say, hey, rather than rent, why don't we buy a house together? And in that way, we can maybe build up some equity, take out a loan together, bear the burden of that. But I know my share is my share, your share is your share. We're just doing this as friends. You could buy a home tenants in common. You each own your own share. Let's say we do 50-50. Now, if I own half and my friend owns half and I die, my half, by virtue of that titling, tenants in common, my half is a part of my estate. It doesn't go to my friend. So what would happen is we would have to then look to the will to see who was going to get your half. Are you passing your half on to someone, or does it become part of your estate? Does your half have to be sold? If it has to be sold, can you sell it to your friend? Does he have first dibs on it? Or do they have to buy you out, or can you force a sale? So it would be really, really important if you're going to enter into some kind of purchase jointly with a friend and have it titled tenants in common, that you understand what the consequences would be of that kind of ownership. Are you going to force someone into a sale, or when they may want to continue living in that home? So you want to understand what the rules are around tenants in common, and you want to make sure that you discuss that with an attorney as you're entering into any kind of transaction like that. There may be spouses who have ownership as tenants in common. Generally, when we have spouses who own things together, we call it tenants by the entireties. And I'll talk about that in a little bit. But you can have spouses who own property tenants in common as well. And there may be estate planning reasons to do that as well. Maybe you have two spouses who kind of put in and have separate families. Maybe they had children from a prior marriage and want to retain their share of their estate for those kids as well. So tenants in common, it doesn't have to be just through with friends. It could be with other relationships as well, including siblings and things like that. We're going to continue our discussion on financial terms as we go through the hour. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. Back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including fee-based asset management. It all starts with personal goals and an understanding of risk tolerance, investment objectives, and the markets. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and you receive a tax deduction. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love on WDIY. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
Welcome back to the show. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. This is your host, Lori Siebert. If you have questions this evening, we are live. The phone number is 610-758-8810. We are talking about financial terms tonight, and I think it helps putting it all together, like I did last week, talking about investment terms, in kind of to put it in perspective. As I said, I think it's so easy these days to go online and Google a term and find a definition. But what does not always come with that is that definition within the context of how it's being used or in relation to other terms that may be related to it. So I thought it was important to talk about investment terms in that way last week, and also to give a high-level perspective of some of the more important types of terms to understand if you're embarking on, you know, financial decisions and investment options and things like that. And when I realized that could be so beneficial, I thought, let's talk about financial terms as well. So we are talking about banking right now. I just talked about tenants in common. Let me talk about the titling between spouses, tenants by the entireties. You don't always see this titling always spelled out. You might say, I have a joint account with my friend, and it might not be apparent that it's tenants in common. You could say, I have a joint account with my sibling, and maybe it's joint with rights of survivorship, and that isn't necessarily spelled out on the statement. The same applies when you have a joint account with a spouse, tenants by the entireties. That is titling between a spouse, and when one spouse dies, the other takes full ownership, and generally, you hear about this when you're talking about real estate, real property. You'll hear in Pennsylvania when a husband and wife own a home, for example, and one spouse dies, you don't necessarily have to go get it retitled in the surviving spouse's name. And I believe, and this is legal, and you could talk to your attorney about it, it could go back to that titling of tenants by the entireties between two spouses. Now, in looking at this, there was some comment that it has to be that way upon that you're acquiring that property while you're married. So if you have a man who owns real estate and then marries and is now married to a wife, it doesn't mean that's automatically tenants by the entireties. So you want to make sure if you change your marital status that you go talk to an attorney about getting the spouse on a deed, if that's what you want, or taking a spouse off if there's a divorce, but not necessarily if someone dies between spouses when it was owned tenants by the entireties. Now, that is a little different than joint ownership with rights of survivorship. You heard me mention you might have an account joint with a sibling, for example. Maybe you guys got a gift from mom and dad. Maybe they gave you two kids, if there's two of you, let's say they gave you $10,000 and you're thinking, gosh, this is really nice of mom and dad, but we're afraid if mom and dad ever need this money, we don't want to spend it. So we're going to put it in a joint account. And in case they ever need it, we're going to still have it. You might open up a joint bank account with a sibling with rights of survivorship. You might have a partner in life that you're not married, you're not siblings, you're not related, but maybe it's your partner and you want to open up a joint account. And if anything happens to you, you want that money to go to them. That is, you could open up an account with joint ownership with rights of survivorship. So it does not have to be spouses. It can be anyone. And then what happens is the parties own title to the assets with the same rights. So if you do open an account, joint ownership with rights of survivorship, and maybe it's a partner and you guys put $10,000 in the account and now you're in a big fight and one's going to leave, they could empty out the account. Joint ownership with rights of survivorship, you both have the same rights over the account. So if you don't want that, there are other options, which I will talk about right now, and that is payable on death or transfer on death. An account, this is an account registration whereby you retain your ownership interest and rights over the account, but at your death, legal title passes to the name beneficiary at your death. This is an interesting way to pass assets to loved ones without giving up control during your life. So a payable on death account might be, let's pretend I have a bank account with $100,000 in it, and I don't want my daughter to go shopping with it, but I want to make sure she gets it because she's been so good to me my entire life. And my other scoundrel child, I won't say if it's a boy or girl, my other scoundrel child, I really don't want them to get their hands on this money any which way, anyhow. I could go into the bank, open up this account, have $100,000 in it, and put on this account registration payable on death to my daughter. She doesn't have any control over the account. She doesn't even have to know about the account. I have the $100,000. I get to use it during my lifetime as however I see fit. I die, and now my daughter finds out it's payable on death to her. All she needs is a death certificate to go into the bank, and she has control over the account. She can change the account over to her name, has control over the account. That's payable on death. She gets it. Just a caveat here, a little footnote, is if you live in Pennsylvania and there's inheritance tax, you have to make sure that the inheritance tax are either going to get paid by virtue of the will through the estate, or if not, then you would still be responsible for any inheritance tax on that type of account. And it may get reported to the state by the bank. Then you would get a notice in the mail if they have your address that you may be subject to this inheritance tax. And then you'd want to work or find out through an attorney whether or not there was an estate and if the estate was actually going to pay the inheritance tax. That's why it's kind of important to understand what kind of titling you have on your bank account and why it would be important if it's a joint account. What kind of ownership interest do you have? Is it going to be subject to inheritance tax if one of you dies? You really want to take a little time to understand asset titling, these financial terms in banking, because it could make a difference in who's getting the accounts, how they're passing, and how they're subject to inheritance tax. So payable on death and transfer on death, you can have that on bank accounts, you can have it on brokerage accounts, and things like savings bonds. You might see it on a savings bond. What happens on a transfer on death and payable on death, that makes it non-probate because you don't have to look to the will to see who gets it. It's passing to an individual. They just need a death certificate. It's by the account registration that it passes. Similarly to joint ownership, joint with rights of survivorship or with a spouse, passes by the account registration, makes it non-probate. Tenants in common, your interest, or if your partner in that tenants in common, in that ownership, joint ownership, that would be subject to probate if it's tenants in common, your separate interest. Okay, so important to know these financial terms. When we come back, I'm going to talk a little bit about FDIC insurance, what that means, and why you might want to understand that a little bit. And then we're going to move into a whole slew of terms on estate planning. Folks, if you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. Back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including income tax preparation for individuals, businesses, estates, and trusts. Tax preparation involves more than putting numbers on a return. It requires planning. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
American folk music offers a variegated pattern of performers and styles. I'm Tom Druckenmiller, your host for In the Tradition. Together, we'll trace the roots and branches of American folk music from the earliest recordings and performers through today's talented players. In the Tradition, Wednesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org. WDIY, Lehigh Valley's community NPR station.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to your Financial Choices. We're talking about financial terms. If you have any questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. 610-758-8810. You can let Lori know if you want to talk live on air or give her your question. She'll write it down and she'll bring it in to me if you're not comfortable talking live on air. We're talking about financial terms. A quick note on the banking information. Recall that I said when you look at the statement, you may not be able to tell what kind of ownership it is. So you really want to make sure, as a gift to your loved ones, that you have indicated this somewhere. Make an inventory of your assets. I have had done shows on doing financial inventory. So do a financial inventory and indicate the titling somewhere in your kind of summary of what you have so that people understand what they're dealing with if you, you know, die suddenly or unexpectedly, that you leave a little bit of a roadmap for your loved ones to know how accounts were titled. All right. Occasionally you will see POD or TOD on an account. And that is, as I mentioned, payable on death or transfer on death. But quite often you're not going to necessarily know joint ownership. I've even noticed in recent years, the banks don't always even put the joint spouse on anymore. Okay. You know, we used to see, you know, John and Mary Doe, and there are times now where I know it's a joint account and I still see John Doe. You want to watch for that. Let me talk about, since we're talking about banking really quickly, FDIC insurance, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. It's an independent agency of the U.S. government that protects you against the loss of your insured deposits. FDIC insured deposits in an FDIC-insured bank or savings association if they fail. And it's up to $250,000 per depositor, per FDIC-insured bank, per ownership category. So if you have $500,000 of cash sitting in an individual account and that bank goes belly up in an FDIC-insured bank and it goes belly up, you would have only been insured up to $250,000. But if you have $250,000 in an individual account and $250,000 in a trust account, for example, in that case, you would be insured $500,000 because you have one ownership, an individual, and a second ownership, a trust. You can also put $250,000 in, you know, five different FDIC-insured banks in, let's say, one ownership category, and you would have coverage of $250,000 times five then. So it's up to $250,000 per depositor, per FDIC-insured bank, per ownership category. Important to know for those people who tuck away tons and tons of cash in the bank. You want to watch out for that. Let's talk about some estate planning terms. A lot of these definitions come from the American Bar Association at AmericanBar.org, AmericanBar.org. I kind of just thought I'll get, you know, a more professional definition. I could probably tell you a lot of these, but thought I'd be real formal tonight. When we're talking about estate planning, we talk about or think about wills, trust, health directives, but what gets so overwhelming about all of it is that there are so many terms for the same thing that quite often people just think it's just too complicated. So I thought I would go over some of that. Let me just throw out some of the terms that I'm going to talk about, and then we'll go through the definitions in no particular order, somewhat alphabetical as I pulled them from the American Bar. I want to talk about living trust, revocable trust, grantor trust, irrevocable trust, maybe IDGT, which is an intentionally defective grantor trust, disclaimer trust, testamentary trust, an islet, talk about probate, non-probate, intestate, fiduciary. So there's all these terms that I think just make it sound so scary. And if we break it down and kind of get our arms around a little bit, it's not as scary. And then we can go in and talk to our attorneys in a little bit more of an informed fashion. So let's talk about some of the terms you might hear. We hear about a beneficiary. A beneficiary is a person who will receive the benefit of property from an estate or trust through the right to receive a bequest or to receive income or trust principal over a period of time. And let me talk about what an heir is, and then I'll kind of put these together. An heir, H-E-I-R, an individual entitled to a distribution of an asset or property interest under applicable state law in the absence of a will. Heir and beneficiary are not synonymous, although they may refer to the same individual in a particular case. So the differentiation here sounds like an heir is someone who's entitled to a distribution in the absence of a will. And a beneficiary is someone who's going to receive the benefit of property from an estate or a trust. When we think about this, we might think in terms of someone I name through my will, trust, or those beneficiary designations on retirement accounts or on the payable on death, transfer on death, in titling joint accounts. Those are my beneficiaries. An heir, in these terms, would be, if I didn't do any of that, who would be my rightful heirs? My rightful heirs, depending on state law, could be my spouse and my children. It would be important to know this, especially for the half of the population who doesn't do estate planning or estate planning documents, to know that your heir and your beneficiary could be different people. You might have a favorite spouse and can't stand any of your children. And if you died, your heir, and without a will, your heirs might include those dreadful children. And I'm just teasing. I have the most wonderful children. I'm just making this stuff up. I have wonderful children. So that's why it's very important for you to understand these terms and the impact of your estate planning. The term grantor, if you've ever heard of a grantor or a grantor trust, what is a grantor? A person, including a testator. Okay, so let's just throw in an extra word there. Who creates or contributes property to a trust. You, an individual, could write up a will, but you could also have a trust. A trust would be a way to protect certain assets from certain people or divvy them up over time. A trust kind of is its own little entity, and you might set up a trust. Well, if you're the person setting up that trust, you could be the grantor. You've contributed property to a trust. If more than one person creates or contributes property to a trust, each person is a grantor with respect to the portion of the trust property attributable to that person's contribution, except to the extent another person has the power to revoke or withdraw that portion. The lesson there is if you set up any kind of a grantor trust with someone else, usually a spouse, you want to make sure you understand all the terms and the powers that you have under that trust, which is why it's so important to work with an attorney when you're thinking about doing any of these things. The grantor is also sometimes referred to as the settlor, the trustor, or the donor. All right? This is why it gets confusing. The grantor could be the settlor, could be the trustor, could be the donor. Or. That's why it's good to talk to an attorney. Folks, we're coming up on the halfway point. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. Back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including estate planning and tax preparation, especially for Pennsylvania and New Jersey residents subject to state inheritance tax reporting. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
You're listening to WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org, serving the Lehigh Valley. The time is 6:30. Lehigh Valley weather, 71 degrees with a few clouds. Tonight, we see a chance of scattered showers and thunderstorms before midnight. Then a slight chance of showers between midnight and 2 a.m. Some of the storms could produce heavy rain. That's a 30% chance, the low around 65. Tomorrow, a chance of showers and thunderstorms mainly after 2 p.m. Again, some of the storms could produce heavy rain, a high near 88. And Thursday night, we see the low temperature going down to around 68. Time is now 6:31. Back to Your Financial Choices with Lori Siebert.
Thank you, Seamus. Welcome back. We're talking about financial terms. I just went over talking about what a grantor was and how they can have so many different names, a grantor being the person who funds a trust. They could be the settlor, trustor, or donor. Now, when we look at what they describe as a living trust, listen to this for a minute. So now, remember, I told you a grantor is someone who puts money or creates a trust. They contribute property to a trust. So now let's talk about what's a trust, a living trust. A trust is created by an individual. Oh, now they're called an individual. They're not a grantor, trustor, settlor, or donor anymore. They're an individual. So a trust created by an individual during his or her lifetime, typically as a revocable trust. So remember a revocable trust? I said that was one of the names. So typically as a revocable trust. Also referred to as an inter vivos trust, a revocable living trust, or a loving trust. If we let people have at this too long, we might come up with 10 other names. So an inter vivos trust means a trust during your lifetime, basically. A revocable living trust is a trust, again, think about it, living trust, living while you're living. You set it up during your lifetime. That is a living trust. We can have so many different names. You could have a trust set up during your lifetime that could be revocable, meaning I can revoke it, or irrevocable, meaning you can't revoke it. And it is a living trust. You could set up during your lifetime an irrevocable life insurance trust. That's called an ILIT. So there are a number of trusts, but basically if you're setting up a trust during your lifetime, we call that a living trust, and it could have many different forms. If you need a trust, but you don't think you need that trust during your lifetime, you just want one on the remote possibility that if you die and money should go to your minor children, you might want to have a trust for your minor children, which might be remote that would happen. You don't want to go through the cost or expense of setting up a trust during your lifetime. What you might do is set up a testamentary trust. What is a testamentary trust? What does that sound like? Last will and testament. So a testamentary trust is a trust that's established in a person's will that will come into operation after the will has been probated, which means assets actually are in someone's estate. You have to have assets in the estate to have the will probated. And then when you probate the will, now you read the terms of the will, and the will says, hey, if assets come into this estate through my will, and I have minor children, in my example here, please set up a trust for their benefit while they're minor children. That could be a testamentary trust. It wouldn't have to just be for minor children. It could be for your adult children that you're just not confident that they're going to be ready and able to handle large sums of money. So you might say, if my children are under the age of 30 or 25, whatever age you decide, working with your attorney, if they're under this particular age, I want to set up a trust during their lifetime until they reach 25, when we want to distribute one third of it. When they reach age 30, maybe another third. And when they reach age 35, the balance. You can use whatever terms you want. But you can make a testamentary trust under your will. And that's why it's not called a living trust, because it doesn't come into fruition until you're gone. It's through your will if there's a probate estate. Guess why else this is important and important for you to understand these terms? Is because if you have gone to all the trouble of having a will drawn up, providing this testamentary trust provision in your will for those minor children or adult children that you want to make sure you're managing the money for them properly, and you have no assets going to the estate, then that testamentary trust might not kick in. Where might you not have assets going to the estate? Let's say you have, you don't really have much in savings or in your estate, but you do have a big retirement account. Let's pretend you have a $200,000 retirement account and you rent. You don't have real estate. You have an apartment or something like that you're renting, but you have this $200,000 retirement account. And 10 years ago, when you first started working, you knew you didn't have your estate planning documents, so you went to the employer, you filled out the paperwork, and you said, primary beneficiary, my spouse, contingent beneficiary, my child. And you never updated your documents. Well, that could be a problem then when you die if, let's say, you and your spouse die simultaneously, and now she's gone, primary beneficiary is gone. Now you have just the contingent beneficiary and it all goes to your child. It's not going through the will then. It's not going into that testamentary trust because you gave it outright according to that beneficiary designation. Then you'd have to have a guardian appointed and it gets all kinds of crazy things. So you really want to understand some of these terms in this language so that, you know, after you leave the attorney's office, you want to go make sure you're doing the proper beneficiary designations, et cetera, that you're supposed to be doing. Seamus, we have a call on line one. Carolyn.
Hi.
Hi, Carolyn. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, good.
This one I might, maybe I should have called in last week. I have a 401k at work.
Uh-huh.
And the company that handles that, are they the custodian of that account? They're the ones that you go to their website and change your contributions and...
Right, right. I would call that the custodian.
Okay. Now, they're always going to have a fee for their services, I'm sure.
Well, it kind of depends. So if you, when you're employed and your employer provides a retirement plan to you, typically the employer is the trustee and they sometimes will hire a third-party administrator. There might be some fees there. And they will generally have a platform of investment options for you, which could be for a particular custodian. It might be through Fidelity. It could be through Merrill Lynch. It could be through Charles Schwab. It could be through any number of custodians offering a platform.
Oh, maybe I'm using the wrong term then, because it's the principal that has all my investments, so maybe they're the administrator.
Right, so you want to be careful as to whether it's the administrator or the custodian. American Funds, they provide what we call record-keeping services. They say, hey, employer, if you put your plan on our platform, here are some investment options your employees can have. And, Carolyn, then what happens is there might be funds available that the employer has chosen from a particular menu. Occasionally, you will have an employer who provides, where the employee can direct the investments themselves, kind of like a link. I know the hospital has something that's called PCRA, personal. Oh, golly, all these terms are just skipping my head right now. But when you go to pick from this menu of investments, the funds themselves will have expenses.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the custodian might have expenses. What happened, gosh, I think it's been a few years now, some rules came out. It's a 404A and 408A or something like that, IRS rules, and I used to have these at my fingertips because I had to go through this myself, that requires employers to disclose all of the costs of their plan. So once a year at a minimum, you're supposed to get a report that talks about all the expenses related to your plan. The expenses can include the expenses of the third-party administrator. It can include the expenses of the funds themselves. Well, it has to, the funds themselves. So once, at least once a year, you should get a report that says this is a required disclosure. Here are the underlying fees. They also have to disclose, I believe, the returns against a benchmark for comparison purposes.
Okay.
So there's a lot of information on that annual disclosure.
I should probably read that fine print more carefully, huh?
Well, I would think that it should be fairly a big alert that you get, or a document that is transmitted to you, and it should be pretty, it's supposed to be plain language.
Okay.
But what started to happen, I think employers thought it was going to be all their responsibility at one point, but then the fund companies or the record keepers, the custodians, really kind of put their arms around that and provide fairly nice reports from what I see now, where they have all those disclosures. So the third-party administrator contributes their fees. If there's any other fees that are the responsibility of the employee, that has to be disclosed. If you take out a loan, that has to be explained and disclosed. Okay. So when you talk about the custodian's fees, that's where you should find all that in one place, of the fees.
But when you look on their website and you see the different things that you can invest in, and there's an expense ratio,
right,
that would be just for that fund,
correct,
right? Okay.
Correct. But from what I'm saying, you should actually be able to go one place and probably see all of that in one place. The performance against a benchmark, the fees for each of the funds, whether you have it in your portfolio or not, from all of the ones that are available. So there should be somewhere where you're going to see that all at once.
Okay, terrific. Do I have time to share a scary story that
Sure.
I heard today with you and your listeners?
Sure.
And this is why it's so important to be proactive, not reactive. It was about a married couple who bought a home together, and there were two names on the deed.
Mm-hmm.
Subsequently, there was a divorce. One spouse got the other spouse to have their name removed from the deed.
Mm-hmm.
But their name was still on the mortgage. So when the house got sold, one spouse got absolutely nothing, but was still liable for half of that mortgage, from what I understand. Now, this is not anybody I know personally. It was a story I heard.
Right, right.
And I think that the spouse that had their name taken off the deed was thinking that they were no longer liable for the mortgage.
Right. Yeah, whenever you look at, and thanks for sharing that story. So whenever couples are going through a divorce, and sometimes this happens with people who are trying to do it themselves, they don't factor in all of the other little implications of those decisions.
Mm.
One of the problems sometimes that couples encounter too when they divorce, if the spouse remaining with the property now has to go apply for a mortgage on their own, and sometimes they don't, you know, qualify, or they don't have the credit. So it runs into a lot of complications. So they definitely want to make sure when they're divvying up assets that they're also looking at the liabilities when they're looking at that and saying who's going to be responsible and having it done the right way. So thanks for sharing that story.
Oh, sure. And thanks for your help.
Okay. Thanks, Carolyn. Thanks for calling. Have a good one.
You too. Bye.
Bye. Folks, we're coming up on our last break. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. I think tonight we're probably going to get through the rest of the estate planning terms, because there's still several more I want to get through. I am not sure we're going to get through the investment-related designations and certifications that I also wanted to highlight. I might have to speed talk by the end of the show. But when we come back, we're going to continue our conversation about financial terms. Again, if you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. Back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services including portfolio management, tax return preparation, and financial planning for the accumulation years, retirement years, and estate distribution. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
In 2017, WDIY is celebrating 22 years on the air. If you listen to WDIY, support the station by becoming a member today. Members are our most reliable source of support. We couldn't be here without you. To become a member, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100. WDIY, serving the Lehigh Valley and beyond.
Welcome back to Your Financial Choices. This is your host, Lori Siebert. And we are talking about financial terms tonight. I just went through a whole litany of terms on trust, living trust. We talked about grantors and testamentary trust, the living trust, which could have so many different names, inter vivos, revocable, living, basically a living trust during your lifetime. You can change your mind, revoke it. Or if you do it irrevocably, it means you can't revoke it. So that is especially a trust that you're going to want to make sure you do properly. An irrevocable trust is a trust that cannot be terminated or revoked or otherwise modified or amended by the grantor. We've already learned about grantor. As modern trust law continues to evolve, however, it may be possible to effect changes to irrevocable trust through court actions or a process called decanting, which allows the assets of an existing irrevocable trust to be transferred to a new trust with different provisions. Here is another reason why it is important to understand these terms, because perhaps you are the beneficiary of an irrevocable trust, and perhaps you did not know that potentially, something could be reworked. That's why you want to make sure you understand that there are might or could be other options, and you'd want to call an attorney and work with an attorney if you find yourself in a situation where something needs to get reviewed or rejiggered. Folks, if you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. You can call and talk live on air or off air, and you can also email questions through the website yourfinancialchoices.com. When we're talking about trust, I mentioned the living trust, irrevocable trust, testamentary trust. There's also special needs trust. I'm going to skip over that. There's also something called the qualified terminable interest property trust. That's called a Q-tip. That kind of trust is when perhaps you have a husband and wife and you want to make sure you take care of your wife if they survive you, but you have children from another family and you want to make sure that they're going to get some of your assets. You might want to put your assets in a Q-tip kind of trust so that during your life or during your spouse's lifetime, they're provided for, but at their demise, the assets then go on to your children. That is where we see that type of thing. Related to all of this is also something called a disclaimer. You could have a disclaimer trust where this trust only, a certain trust might only pop in if someone disclaims property. So let's talk about a disclaimer because it's not just for trust, it's for other property as well. The disclaimer is the renunciation or refusal to accept a gift or bequest or the receipt of insurance proceeds, retirement benefits, and the like under a beneficiary designation in order to allow the property to pass to alternate takers. To be a qualified disclaimer and thereby not treated as a gift by the disclaimant, that person who's making the disclaimer must be made within 9 months and before the disclaimant has accepted any interest in the property in order to avoid a tax triggering event. In light of the current high gift and estate tax exemption amounts, it may be feasible in many instances to disclaim even after that time period to accomplish non-tax goals. State laws addressing disclaimers may differ, and some wills and trusts might include express provisions governing what happens to assets or interests that are disclaimed. Be certain to consider all of these issues before disclaiming. Let me try to put this in English for you. Husband and wife have a large estate. Husband passes away. Wife inherits everything. Wife doesn't need all the money. Wife doesn't want all the money. And wife plans to gift a bunch of the money to her three children because she knows she doesn't need it. One of the assets that the wife has inherited is an IRA. She doesn't need it. She wants to disclaim it so that it goes to her children. One of the first things that would happen, though, she doesn't get to decide who it's going to. It would have been the decedent who decided. And how might they have decided? On the beneficiary designation form, they put the primary beneficiary as the spouse. They put the contingent beneficiary as the three children. Such that if the spouse disclaims and says, I don't want it, it is as if she predeceased. So now the custodian or the trustee of that IRA account would say, okay, decedent died. Spouse was primary. She has now disclaimed. It's as if she no longer exists. Who was the next beneficiary listed? Oh, decedent listed three children as the contingent beneficiary. If the surviving spouse does the proper disclaimer, the three children could then inherit the IRA. We had this happen. Why does this work or could work in some cases very well? The three children now become beneficiary of dad's IRA. They set up beneficiary IRAs for themselves. So it's called dad's IRA for benefit of child one, dad's IRA for benefit of child two, dad's IRA for benefit of child three. Each of them now have a beneficiary IRA. Each of them have a required minimum distribution over their own life expectancy because they set it all up properly. Their life expectancy is much longer than mom's, so they have a much smaller required minimum distribution than mom would have had. And it's based on each of their own tax rates. And each of these kids in my story at some point didn't have any other taxable income. It was a pretty good estate planning and tax planning strategy that was available, and it depends on the circumstances. But understanding these terms and what's available to you can really empower you in your financial decisions, hopefully help you move forward, help you fill in the gaps and have a little understanding that you can go talk to your attorneys and let them know exactly what you want and how to make it all work. And it requires a coordination, of course, of your estate planning, your documents, and your asset titling, and your beneficiary designations, and not just beneficiary designations, but also contingent beneficiary designations. This is why I drive this home all the time. Very, very important. It's not just in case something happens to both of you, which is what I always think might happen if you're a husband and wife, but what might happen to the survivor if they don't need it? Can they pass it on? Contingent beneficiaries. It's powerful estate planning opportunities. If you don't have a will, then your assets that are in your name alone, that aren't otherwise passing by beneficiary designation or asset titling, would be subject to the intestate laws per your state. When one dies without a valid will, such that the decedent's estate is distributed in accordance with the state's intestacy laws. And again, in Pennsylvania, that could include your children as well as your spouse. So many people just think, oh, if I die, everything's going to my spouse. That is not always the case. It depends on state law. And recall that I said your estate. If you have beneficiary designations, that's how that would pass. It wouldn't go through your estate. Let me see what else I have to cover here. Healthcare power of attorney, a document that appoints an individual as agent to make healthcare decisions when the grantor of the power is incapacitated, also referred to as a healthcare proxy. Real quick, probate, the court-supervised process of providing the validity of a will and distributing property under the terms of the will or in accordance with a state's intestacy law in the absence of a will. So the court-supervised process, it doesn't mean you're going to court necessarily, folks. So don't be afraid by that. Probate, you go, the executor gets appointed, and then the executor goes through that process of making sure they're following the terms of the will and distributing the property accordingly and paying the bills and the debts and taxes and inheritance taxes and all of that. So that's probate. Non-probate means you don't have to go through probating the will. You don't have to go to the register of wills. You, the property could transfer with a death certificate, for example, if it is a joint account or a payable on death account. If it's a trust, then you have trust provisions in the trust document that would determine how that gets distributed. Let me talk about per stirpes for a minute, because recall I was just talking about beneficiaries and beneficiary designations and contingent beneficiary designations. A lot of times what we're talking about there is on retirement accounts or life insurance. When we say to, I'll give you an example. Let's say I say to my spouse, and if not my spouse, then my three children, and this is 50 years from now, my spouse passed away, and it's just my three children left. And at the time I had done it, I just had three kids. If I don't indicate per stirpes, it could really complicate things. Let's pretend I have three children and two of them have three children each, and my one child has no children. If one of my children that has three kids passes away and I don't put per stirpes, then their share could end up passing to the other two kids versus to their own children. So per stirpes is a Latin phrase meaning per branch, and it's a method for distributing property according to the family tree, whereby descendants take the share their deceased ancestor would have taken if the ancestor were living. Each branch of the named person's family is to receive an equal share of the estate. If all children are living, each child would receive a share. But if a child is not living, that child's share would be divided equally among the deceased child's children. All right? That would be your grandchildren. So you want to pay attention to that per stirpes designation. There's also something called per capita. So if I have three kids and I say per capita, it's as is, as I mentioned, if one dies, then it would go to my other two surviving children. Therefore, my grandchildren may be cut out. And that may not have been what I meant to happen. Please make sure you understand when you're naming beneficiaries and contingent beneficiaries, whether or not it's important to put that per stirpes designation there. All right, we just have a couple minutes left. I think I covered a lot of the estate planning terms that I wanted to. It's not all inclusive. We always recommend that you talk to your attorney or financial advisor when you're talking about estate planning. Make sure you know what applies to you and make sure how you're impacted. Do your financial inventory, understand how your assets are titled, understand your beneficiary designations and contingent beneficiary designations on retirement accounts, life insurance, pensions, whatever you have. Make sure you take a picture of all of it. Real quick, let me talk about some designations. CFA, Chartered Financial Analyst. A CFA charter is arguably the gold standard for certification in the world of investments. It's an investment-centric program and not necessarily financial planning. So CFA is someone who's really understanding investments and you know, how to analyze financials and statements and things like that. CLU, Chartered Life Underwriter, offered by the American College. CLU is the gold standard in education for life insurance professionals. Not as popular as it used to be because so many of them have turned to certified financial planners, CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professional. That does seem to be the increasingly the big designation for financial planners. We have CPAs, Certified Public Accountants. Technically, CPA is not a designation, but a state license to practice accounting. Educational requirements for CPAs are quite extensive and require a big comprehensive exam, just like the CFP does as well. Some of these terms and some of the definitions around them are from Michael Kitches, who has a website, kitches.com, kitces.com. Enrolled agents, they're someone who are licensed by the federal government to prepare tax returns that can represent taxpayers before the IRS, but only on certain matters. So a CPA and attorney can do that. Enrolled agents are a little bit more limited. So those are some of the big terms. I didn't talk about retirement planning terms or retirement terms or tax terms tonight. We'll do those on other shows. I really appreciate folks listening. I hope you learn a lot, and I hope you've learned a lot. Again, podcast available on WDIY.org all the time and on Your Financial Choices. Next week, we have Music Fest. I won't be here. We're taking a break. But then the following week, we're going to have representatives from Phoebe Home to discuss a new option to nursing homes with in-home continuing care with Pathstones. Coming up next, Tom Druckenmiller with In the Tradition Folk Music. Thank you, Seamus. Thank you, Lori. Thanks, Carolyn, for calling in. Remember, pay attention, be proactive, not reactive, and make the best of your financial choices. Have a great week.
You're listening to WDIY Allentown, 88.1 FM and WDIY.org, serving the Lehigh Valley.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. The Justice Department is considering a plan to sue universities over their affirmative action policies. NPR's Kerry Johnson reports the Trump administration is concerned about discrimination